Having arrived several years ago at the theological position or the scriptural position that God's laws, that is His commandments, statutes, and judgments as found in the Old Testament, are part and parcel of God's new covenant plan for us today, I determined some time back to follow in the steps of Ezra in this sense. Setting my heart to study the law of Yahweh, that being the Hebrew pronunciation of what should be in the Old Testament instead of Lord and God in many cases. Setting my heart to study the law of Yahweh and to practice it and to teach His statutes and ordinances in Israel. Again, I have set one of my goals is to follow in His footsteps in doing that. Of course, you don't find that very often today, because why in the world would you want to follow in the footsteps of Ezra if indeed all that has been done away? But now that I've come to a scriptural understanding, a better scriptural new covenant understanding of God's laws, indeed that is a goal of mine, and it should be the goal of most, if not all, of the preachers across this land today. As a result, I periodically, as you know, take down, as it were, one of the Ten Commandments and do a series on it and its respective statutes and judgment. Presently, I'm in the midst of preaching a series on the Fourth Commandment. In the previous messages, I scripturally established that the Sabbath is indeed a part of God's new covenant plan for us today under the new covenant. And I then in the previous messages as well, have detailed how God does intend, or how God intends us to keep the Sabbath under the new covenant. This message will be the fifth part of the series on the Fourth Commandment. For a text for this particular message, let's turn to Exodus chapter 31. We've used as a text in the past Exodus chapter 20, where we find the commandments detailed there. And we've also used Deuteronomy chapter 5, which is a reiteration of the same. In this case, let's turn to Exodus chapter 31. Exodus 31, beginning with verse 13, or beginning with verse 12. It says, "And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, You shall surely observe my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am Yahweh who sanctifies you. Therefore you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death, for whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. For 6 days' work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to Yahweh. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever. For in 6 days Yahweh made heaven and earth, but on the seventh day he ceased from labor and was refreshed. And when he had finished speaking with him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written by the finger of God." Verse 13 again. "But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, You shall surely observe my Sabbath, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am Yahweh who sanctifies you." Now, in one of the earlier messages, I already dealt with the fact that the Sabbath commandment, the fourth commandment, in a sense, was to be a sign between God and His people from that point on perpetually. And that is stated in verse 13. But did you catch anything else of interest in that particular verse? Did you notice that the word Sabbath is pluralized in this verse? He doesn't say, "But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, You shall observe my Sabbath." No, he says, "You shall observe my Sabbaths." Why do you suppose that is? That he would pluralize the word Sabbath? And there's no question, you can go back to the Hebrew, the original language for the Old Testament, and there's no question that word, the Hebrew word Sabbaton, has been pluralized in this particular case and in other cases as well. Why do you suppose that is? Verse 14 through 18 is specifically dealing with the weekly Sabbath. So why do you suppose that Yahweh inspired Moses to pluralize the Hebrew Sabbaton in this particular case? Well, could it be that there's more than one Sabbath? More than just the weekly Sabbath? It's interesting, just as over 95% of the material that I have in books, on tape, in periodicals, in my file, the material I have in my file, is devoted to the win of the Sabbath, in like manner, when it comes to, the same is also true when it comes to the weekly Sabbath. In other words, less than 5% of what I possess on the Sabbath, in books and tapes and so forth, is devoted to the other Sabbaths. Just a minuscule amount. And I'm sure it's the case with every preacher across this land. That the far biggest majority of the material that they have is devoted to the win of the Sabbath, and that being to the win of the weekly Sabbath. And everything else is almost ignored. The how and the what of the Sabbath that we're trying to deal with, that I'm trying to deal with in this series. And the other Sabbaths are nearly completely ignored. Consequently, the majority of those in modern Christendom don't even know that there are other Sabbaths. And that should come as no surprise to us when we have the majority of modern preachers denouncing God's laws as pertinent or applicable to us today. It's no surprise. And consequently, very few follow the lead of Ezra in studying, observing, and teaching the statutes and the judgments of our God's laws. Very few today. How tragic. That shouldn't be that way. On the other hand, when one does study Yah's laws to show himself approved, as it were, it is quite apparent indeed that there are other Sabbaths in addition to the weekly Sabbath. This commandment is no different than from the previous three that I've already dealt with in previous series, nor the six commandments to follow, in that this commandment does not and cannot stand on its own. And that too would probably be a surprising statement probably to the majority of people today in most churches. Nonetheless, it's nonetheless true. But that is a fact. The law of God is made up of three integral parts: commandments, statutes, and judgments. Turn, if you will, to verify this, to Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy chapter 5, and beginning with verse 31. Verse 31, "But as for you, stand here by me, that I may speak to you all the commandments and statutes and the judgments which you shall teach them, that they shall observe them in the land which I give them to possess. So you shall observe to do just as Yahweh your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right or the left. You shall walk in the way which Yahweh your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess." Now, keep in mind that Moses had just outlined the Ten Commandments in the first part of this chapter. And for so many people across the land today, they think that that is basically constitutes all that Moses was given on Mount Sinai. And yet we can see from this verse, from the verse we just read, verse 31, that there's more to God's laws than just the Ten Commandments. Or it might be put this way: there's more to the Ten Commandments than just what is stated in each commandment. All functional law, and I put the emphasis on functional, all functional law consists of those three integral parts. You have to have all three parts to make it a functional law: commandments, statutes, and judgments. Now, I've used this before, for the sake of those who may not have heard it both here and on the tape ministry, let me use it again. Take man's laws, which are quote-unquote laws. There's only one lawmaker. Any law that man happens to come up with that is not already in existence through God is no law at all. It's just usually a transgression of God's law already. But using the law in that sense, man's law, man has traffic, men have traffic laws, we have traffic laws. And one of the commandments under his traffic laws is, "Thou shall not speed." Now, it's not necessarily stated like one of the Ten Commandments, but that's basically what it is. It is a commandment commanding us, "Thou shall not speed." Now, we wouldn't understand what speeding is. We take it for granted because we've lived with it for so many years in this land. But we would not understand what speeding was unless, except for the fact that we have statutes that explain what speeding is. For example, "Thou shalt not speed," over 20 miles an hour in a school zone, or thou shalt not speed over 30 miles an hour in a residential area, or 55 on a two-lane highway, or 65 on a four-lane highway, or in Montana, any speed you want to go at is safe. But the point is that we would not understand what speeding was, or all of the whole intent of what speeding is, the commandment, thou shalt not speed, without the statutes that in each particular situation explain what speeding is. Now, I've used that before. You're all fairly well familiar with that. The same is true, is obviously true from what we just read in Deuteronomy chapter 5. The same is true with each of God's Ten Commandments. Take the commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. If we limit this commandment to just what so many preachers and Christians across this land, and myself not so long ago, want to limit it to, that is, to marital unfaithfulness. If we limit it to just that, we minimize the biggest part of what that commandment, the biggest majority of what that commandment implies and is for. For example, incest. Thou shalt not commit incest. Thou shalt not commit homosexuality. Thou shalt not commit bestiality. Thou shalt not commit interracial union. You shall not have interracial unions. You shall not have forbidden lineage relationships, and a few others as well. All of which constitute committing adultery. Or in other words, each of the prohibitions against those immoral acts are statutes under the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. Those are all statutes which help us to explain and understand the full import, the full intent of that commandment. As a result, you can see that how most of modern Christianity has minimized and even neutralized the laws of God by their illiteracy on just this one aspect of God's law. Again, the perfect example is the seventh commandment, and that adultery means so much more than usually they apply it to. Each commandment is explained by its statutes and is enforced by its judgment. To be a functional law, again, it requires all three integral parts, and it's no different when it comes to the fourth commandment. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to deal with the what of the commandment, because the what of the commandment is not found just in the commandment itself, as it's stated. That is, in order for us to fully understand and enforce this commandment, its statutes and its judgments must be understood. So what are the statutes which belong under the fourth commandment? Or to put it another way, what are the other Sabbaths that Yahweh expects us to observe under this commandment? There are three categories of Sabbaths, and I use the word categories because under each category there are additional Sabbaths. But three categories of Sabbaths. The weekly Sabbath is, of course, the most frequently observed Sabbath, once a week. Now, there is no order necessarily provided for us in the Scriptures, but having begun with the weekly Sabbath, the most frequent Sabbath, I will address the remaining Sabbaths in a succession of decreasing frequency. The succession will lead us from the weekly Sabbath to the 50-year Sabbath. Following the weekly Sabbath, let's next look at the annual Sabbaths, those normally known as feast days or holy festivals. Now, I won't spend a lot of time on these because I recently preached a series entitled Feast Days, Yea or Nay, in which I scripturally demonstrated that the sacred festivals as found in the Old Covenant are statutes under the Fourth Commandment which are to be conditionally, and I emphasize the word conditionally, kept under this new covenant dispensation. And if you haven't heard the series, whether you're already observing the feast days or not, I strongly encourage that you do so. Those of you who may not, who do not currently keep the Sabbath or observe the Sabbath, need to reevaluate doing so. And those who are already observing them may need to reevaluate your attitude and your approach to the Sabbath. Anyway, that can be found in that particular series. Now, for the sake of this message, let's look at a passage that establishes the feast as Sabbath, or actually the Sabbath as one of the feasts. Leviticus 23. Leviticus starting with verse 23 and beginning with verse 1. Yahweh spoke again to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, Yahweh's appointed times, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, my appointed times are these. For 6 days' work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, a holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It is a Sabbath to Yahweh in all your dwellings. These are the appointed times of Yahweh. Holy convocations which you shall proclaim at the times appointed for them. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at twilight, is Yahweh's Passover." And then on through the rest of the chapter. Now note that in this passage we are dealing, first of all, it very clearly in verse 2 speaks of holy convocations, appointed times. In the new, in the King James Version, I believe you'll find that it refers to the feast days. Indeed, the Hebrew word that is normally translated as feasts. And so it's identifying, it's dealing primarily with the feast days, but note that in dealing with these feasts or holy convocations, that it begins by identifying the weekly Sabbath as one of these feasts. Again, a fact that I'm sure the majority across this land don't understand. Again, if for no other reason, simply because the Old Testament and God's laws are very seldom studied across this land. But even for those who do, I think it's sometimes missed that this passage takes the weekly Sabbath and makes it one of the feasts, right along with Passover, with Pentecost, and Tabernacles. And that found, of course, as you proceed through the rest of the chapter. Mentioned first, I believe that the weekly Sabbath is to be understood as the primary feast or the commandment under which these other feasts or statutes or upon which these other feasts or statutes hang. So, what are the annual feasts or Sabbaths? Let's just deal with them briefly. They're found right here in Leviticus 23. Let's begin. We've already seen that we have the weekly Sabbath as one. Then we move to the Passover as found in verse 4. Verse 5. In the first month, in the 14th day of the month, at twilight is Yahweh's Passover. Then in verse 6, we have the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Verse 6. Then on the 15th day of the same month, there is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to Yahweh. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. Then in verses 15 and 16. And it goes in between these passages or verses, it goes on to explain these feasts in more detail. But just to establish what they are, verses 15 and 16, we find Pentecost, where it says, "You shall also count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day when you brought in the sheaf or the wave offering, there shall be 7 complete Sabbaths. You shall count 50 days to the day after the seventh Sabbath. Then you shall present a new grain offering to Yahweh." That didn't bring out Pentecost, but it should be in there, did it? Now, there's a verse that brings out the word Pentecost. 50 days is referring to the Pentecost. Anyway, that does establish Pentecost. But then we have trumpets in verse 24, where it says, Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, "In the seventh month, in the first of the month, you shall have a rest, a reminder by blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation." The Feast of Trumpets, verse 27, the Day of Atonement. On exactly the 10th day of this month, of this seventh month, is the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. And you shall humble your souls and present an offering by fire to Yahweh. And then lastly, in verse 34, we have tabernacles, or what's also known as booths. Verse 35, on the first day is the holy convocation. You shall do no... Verse 34, excuse me. Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, on the 15th of the seventh month is the feast of booths, or tabernacles, for 7 days to Yahweh. Now, from this particular chapter, there's further proof that the feasts are indeed Sabbaths or Fourth Commandment statutes. First, they are identified as holy convocations, the same as we have found earlier and in this passage that the Sabbath is identified as. Secondly, it is specifically specified that no work is to be done, at least on the high Sabbaths of these feast days. In other words, they are to be times of rest, being that's what the Sabbath, the word Sabbath literally means, meaning rest. They are to be times of rest, that is, Sabbaths unto Yahweh. Now, in the book of Exodus, it reduces these 6 festivals down to 3 major feasts. Turning to Exodus 23. Exodus 23, and starting with verse 14. Verse 14, 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. Now, Leviticus brings out that there's 6 feasts. And yet, Exodus, Moses tells us here that he says there's 3 times that we're going to have a feast. Well, they combine some of the minor feasts into the major feast. 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Included with that would be Passover. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. Also you shall observe the Feast of Harvest of the First Fruits, that known as, First Fruits of your labors from what you sow in the field, which is also known as Pentecost. And then the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather it in the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times of the year all your males shall appear before the Lord Yahweh. Again, the first month in the Hebrew calendar was to be Passover, and unleavened bread was to be observed. In the second month, Pentecost, and in the 7th month, trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and tabernacles. And you do see that they sometimes are called by different names as well, ingathering and so forth. Now, as I pointed out in my feast day series, and this is important, and I'm not going to go into detail in this because it's already in that feast day series for the most part, but we must be careful that we do not approach these feasts from the same approach or from the same perspective as they did under the Mosaic Covenant. If the different approaches, the Abrahamic / Christian, which are essentially one and the same thing, Christ just brought us back to what God intended for us originally under the Abrahamic Covenant. It was because of their disobedience under the Abrahamic Covenant that the Mosaic Covenant was even added. And that's why I say under the different approaches from the Abrahamic / Christian covenant and the Mosaic, if those differences are not recognized, then the only logical conclusion or end is that we keep every type and shadow of those or of these feasts, which will inevitably lead us to once again, literally, sacrificing beef and sheep sacrifices, which indeed would be a blasphemy to Yahshua, Hebrew pronunciation of our Savior's name, Yahshua, and His sacrifice at Calvary on the cross. That's not what God intends. Under this new covenant, the Christian covenant, we are to observe the Sabbaths, the feast days, because they are statutes under the fourth commandment. That I do not think can be denied. However, they're to be done in remembrance of Yahweh's great deliverances and blessings both past and present. Looking to the past as a celebration of our Israelitish history, and to the present in Christ as our ultimate victory and deliverance. And again, there's a different perspective and there's a different application than what we found the Israelites were bound to and bound under the Mosaic Covenant. Now, if we were living under Yahweh's laws here in America today, in addition to the weekly Sabbath, we would also Sabbath as a nation in holy convocation 3 times a year. In essence, 3 national holidays. That's what in God, they would be our holidays. They should be our holidays. They are our holidays because we're the literal descendants of those people and those people whom God gave those great victories to. Three national holidays. The first, Passover and Unleavened Bread, lasting 8 days. Pentecost, the second, being a 1 day holiday. And the third, Trumpets, Atonement, and Tabernacles, lasting 23 days. 3 weeks. Now, how would you like to have holidays like that in this country? How much better than what we currently have or what we have under our current government today? But that's not all. From the annual Sabbath, we want to next look at what's known as the sabbatical year, or a Sabbath which lasted for a whole year, 1 in every 7 years. There are 2 primary aspects to this Sabbath which can be gleaned from 2 different passages. First, Leviticus chapter 25. Again, we're spending a lot of time in different verses and passages. It's because of the type of study this particular is, as we dig into the commandments, and especially since time is evolved, has passed us by since the time when these commandments were first instituted, and planned by God to be passed on from father to son. We have removed ourselves so far from them, if for no other reason than the fact that so many preachers today are preaching against them for today, that we need to dig in and we need to find out. We've lost the understanding of what these things are. And this isn't the most exciting, exhilarating study of the commandments that we've had thus far, but nonetheless, it's important that we understand these, even if it is a little laborious and amounts to spending a little bit more time in the Scriptures than what we maybe do with other messages. Anyway, there's two different aspects to this this sabbatical year, or this yearly Sabbath, that can be gleaned from two different passages. Again, beginning with with Leviticus chapter 25, beginning with verse 1. Yahweh then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to Yahweh. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its crops. But during the seventh year the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to Yahweh. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvest aftergrowth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. And all of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food yourself, and your male and female slaves, and your hired man, and your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you. Even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat." Now, from this passage, it can be seen that every seventh year, the land was to be Sabbathed, rested, or to lay fallow. It's interesting that, like Yahweh's food laws, which have been even proven by secularists to be the healthiest way for us to eat, in like manner, it's a fairly well understood agricultural fact that resting the land every seventh year is ultimately the best for the land, and that much improved crops will be the results of doing so. And also, it eliminates the need for the pesticides and the herbicides that we use today. Not that it's going to eliminate all weeds throughout the other 6 years and all the other pests, but it does. It's amazing what that seventh year rest does to the land. Somehow, God has built it in so that when you rest the land the seventh year, those things that we are polluting our crops with and polluting the land with are totally unnecessary. Yet how many farmers do you know that are keeping this Sabbath? Yeah, I'd venture to say that there isn't one of us that could name one farmer who's doing so. Yet, before becoming too judgmental about that, let's be reminded that for some time, from both the religious and government perspective, which are essentially one and the same, we have not had Yahweh's laws promoted in this land. The majority of our farmers don't even know this. Now, not that there hasn't been agricultural studies into the seventh year Sabbath for the land, as I've just explained, but the majority of our farmers are simply ignorant, from both a government and a religious perspective. Now, not that it cannot be done, because there are some who are doing so. Not that it can't be done, because again it is. But under our current government, economic, and religious climate, that is, under our current quote-unquote Babylonian captivity, it's been made extremely difficult for our farmers to comply to this statute. Our ungodly, usurious economic system alone makes it nearly impossible for farmers to do so. If the farmers were to let their land lay fallow for the Sabbath year, for 1 year, they would be, at least the vast majority of them, would be unable to make their payments to their usurers that year, and as a result, they would lose their land to our nation's greedy, reprobate thieves, i.e., to, quote-unquote, our friendly neighborhood banker. And that may be news to you, that such would be considered. You know, in most churches across this land, the banker sits in the front seat and is the high position of being elder or deacon or something like that. It shows how perverted and how things have been switched. The fulfillment of Isaiah, calling evil good and good evil. You look to the Scriptures and you look to God's law and His morality, and it's so clear that usury is absolutely condemned or put in the same category. As a matter of fact, as most of us know, it's a statute under "thou shalt not commit usury" is a statute under the commandment "thou shalt not steal." Thou shalt not charge interest, in other words, is despicable in God's sight, because when you study into it and you understand it, it's downright thievery, theft. And so God condemns it in His Word. But that's what would happen. The farmer is put in such a predicament that if he does, under the system that we currently live on, and not in some cases that it's not a result of their own greed, of wanting too much land and adding land to land, which God also commands us against. But in most cases, most farmers just simply appear to have no choice. And they're put in a terrible predicament because of the situation they're in. They can't afford, quote-unquote, to allow their land to go fallow for 1 year, because their land would soon be taken away from them. The Antichrist must gleefully be rubbing their hands in their counting houses, knowing the predicament that they've put our farmers in, some of the most independent people in our land, and those are the ones they most joyfully want to come after. On one hand, if they obey Yahweh, they lose their land. And on the other hand, if the farmers don't obey Yahweh, they then, in order to retain possession of their land, they then fall under the judgment of Yahweh. Now, if it's difficult for you to believe that there are such people who think this way, then consider Proverbs chapter 4 and verses 14 through 16. It says, "Do not enter the path of the wicked, and do not proceed in the way of evil men. Avoid it. Do not pass by it. Turn away from it and pass on." And then verse 16, listen specifically. It says, For they cannot sleep unless they do evil. And they are robbed of sleep unless they make someone stumble. People who they can't sleep unless they're doing it. Consider also Samuel Roth's admission in his book, Jews Must Live. On page 71, he wrote this. He says, "The whole purpose of a Jew in business was to get the best of the goy. When the goy had been cheated, business was good. When the Jew had just come out even, business was very bad, bad indeed. For the greater the harm he had done in a business transaction with a goy, the deeper appeared the narrative delight of the Jew." And then also on page 73, he wrote this. It was practically a moral obligation on the part of every conscientious Jew to fool and cheat the goy wherever and whenever possible. And that's why I say you can almost see them joyfully rubbing their hands in their counting houses, knowing the predicament they've put our farmers in. And this mindset, it's hard for me to comprehend that. And I'm sure it's hard for you to comprehend that there can be people who live by that standard. And yet it's difficult for us to understand that, because it's not our mindset. It's not natural for us, where it seems to be for them. Nonetheless, it does exist. As a result, our farmers have been put in a terrible predicament. It's a very serious situation for all of us, because God made it clear that the violation of the seventh year land Sabbath was one of the reasons why Israel was conquered and removed from the land. Turn to Leviticus 26. We're still in 25, just one chapter here. Leviticus chapter 26, beginning with verse 27. Says, "Yet in spite of this, you do not obey me, but act with hostility against me. Then I will act with wrathful hostility against you, and I will punish you seven times for your seven sins. Further, you shall eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters you shall eat. I then will destroy your high places, and cut down your incense altars, and heap your remains on the remains of your idols, for my soul shall abhor you. I will lay waste your cities as well, and will make your sanctuaries desolate, and I will not smell your soothing aromas. And I will make the land desolate, so that your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled over it. You, however, I will scatter among the nations and will draw out a sword after you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. Verse 34, then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, and it will observe the rest which it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were living on it. This particular statute of the fourth commandment was neglected by Israel, by ancient Israel, 70 different times. You talk about a fulfillment of God's promise, a prophecy from God Himself of His judgment upon Israel. He said that the land will rest because of your disobedience and will take care of all of the Sabbaths. They disobeyed this statute of this commandment 70 different times while in the land. Hence, they were 70 years in the Babylonian captivity. God fulfills His word. Every seventh year, throughout the years that they were in land, 70 times they did it, and so He put them in captivity 70 times. Turn to 2 Chronicles 36, establishes this point even further. 2 Chronicles 36, beginning with verse 19. Verse 19, then they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem. Now this is the final attack upon Jerusalem before they were taken into Babylonian captivity. Verse 19, and they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all its fortified cities with fire and destroyed all its valuable articles. And those who had escaped from the sword He carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and to his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land had enjoyed its Sabbath 70 years. All the days of its desolation it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. This particular statute of God, of this commandment, God says, I am one fashion or another, I'm going to make sure that my land enjoys its Sabbaths. And while Israel was taken away captive into Babylonian captivity, that's exactly what happened. The land lay fallow for 70 years, taking care of the 70 years that it had been neglected previously. You know, I see ourselves right now in semi-captivity. I don't certainly see it as bad as what the Israelites had in ancient times under the Egyptian bondage or under the Babylonian or under the Assyrian bondage. I see it as a semi-captivity. It's actually probably worse than that, but at least in the minds of the majority of the people, they see themselves free and somewhat act like they're free. But indeed, it's still a captivity. When you start examining the freedoms that we've lost in the 200 years plus that this nation has been in existence, there is no question that we have gone from freedom to captivity. At least a semi-captivity. Consequently, if we as a people continue down the path that we're currently on in this country, and if God chooses to repeat history, our captivity could become much more severe, much more inclusive than it already is. And that's why it's imperative for us, especially us who understand some of these things, for us to remove ourselves from the grip of this Antichrist system as much as we individually possibly can at this time. And it's going to begin with us individually doing so. If we're ever going to remove it, it begins with us individually and it's spreading it out. And thankfully, God is allowing that to do so. So much more in the last 12 to 24 months than the last 10 years that I've been involved in this understanding. God is starting to pass it on, starting to multiply. But it's got to begin with us as individuals. It's imperative that we throw off this Antichrist system wherever we can in our own individual lives. Which begins, of course, by making Christ King, Lord, and Savior. Let me put it in reverse. Savior, Lord, and King. So many people understand He needs to be Savior. And some understand that He needs to be Lord, but very few understand that He also needs to be our King, our only King. And everything else has to be subservient to Him. It begins with that. Next, for the farmer, for all of us, it should mean doing everything in our power to get out of debt, extricating ourselves from the clutches of the users so as to not be enslaved to them. Don't forget, Proverbs 22:7, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. wonder how many bankers share that verse with their potential lenders before they lend their money to them. I doubt any of them. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. And that's exactly what you are. A slave if you're in debt, and especially if you're in debt paying usury or interest. Your slavery is just that much more inclusive when usury is involved. Or, another way to put it, it's just that much more compounded when there's usury or interest involved. Take the advice from Solomon. It's found in Proverbs chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. He says, "My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor," that same Hebrew word translated surety in Proverbs 6 is also translated as mortgage in Nehemiah chapter 3, I believe it is, or chapter 5, excuse me. I think it means much more than just going surety for your neighbor. I think if you look at the Hebrew word, it seems to imply being caught, being ensnared, being enslaved, as with any debt. And he says, "My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, you have been ensnared with the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth. Do this then, my son, and deliver yourself." One translation translates it, "extricate yourself." Continuing, "Since you have come into the hand of your neighbor, go humble yourself and importune your neighbor. Do not give sleep to your eyes nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand and like a bird from the hand of the fowler." I mean, that's pretty graphic. He's saying, man, if you're in debt, you're a slave. And he says, you need to do everything in your power to get out of debt. If it means sacrificing some, then sacrifice. It's much better to sacrifice and be a freeman than to be in debt and be a slave. And our farmers, of all people, need to understand this. I mean, we all do. But the farmers need to understand they need to get out of debt because they're in a terrible predicament just in this one area alone because of going into debt. I don't believe that being charged usury is a sin. There's no indication of that in God's law. The charging of interest. And if you're involved in that, know that God considers you a thief. And I doubt there's anyone here that is. Any bankers? Come up here right to the front seat if you are. So we can possibly hang you. but if it's the usurer, not the usury, that's sinning. But it certainly is true that you're a fool if you're in being charged, if you're in that predicament and don't need to be or can find get yourself out of it. Don't think, you know, usury is taking a loan out is so often promoted as a way to get ahead. They never tell you it's slavery. It's not a way to get ahead. It's a way to dig yourself a hole from which so many people today can't get out of. And how many farmers across this land on a daily basis are losing their lands to the usurers, to the bankers, being stolen from them because in many cases there's no way to pay back interest. And I could go into detail of how that all works, but I won't in this particular message. Others have and done a better job than I would do. It's slavery. And those farmers who are losing their land, let alone they find themselves not being unable to obey God. In this one particular area, at least. When the farmer delivers himself from these fowlers, he can then keep this land Sabbath, this statute, without fear of losing his land. When we're faithful to God, we understand He is faithful to us. It's the principle that's found stated in 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 14, where it says, "And if my people who are called by my name, humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and forgive their sins and will heal their land." If we're faithful to Him, He's faithful to Him. Or as another passage says, draw near to God and He will draw near to you. If God seems so far away, guess who moved? It wasn't God. He's always remained in His spot. It's us. Draw near to Him and He will draw near to you. Be faithful to Him, and He will be faithful to you. When we trust Him enough to do with the land what He asks, specifically in this particular case, to let the land lay fallow. What is it that he promises us in this case? Simply a bumper crop on the sixth year, enough to provide for the seventh, eighth, and ninth years. Leviticus chapter 25. How much time do I have? Okay, I think we've got time. We'll look at this. Leviticus chapter 25, because some people would question, well, how in the world can I allow, how can I make it? How can I survive? Well, if you think about it just from the standpoint, let alone what God promises on the sixth year, if we're faithful to Him, He says, I'll be faithful to you. And He proved it over and over and over again when Israel in the past was obedient. But just if you just even consider it from the standpoint of look at the excess of crops that God blesses Israelite farmers with, the greatest farmers of this land. We feed most of the rest of the world. And if we had to, we'd just pull it back and say, hey, this is going to be ours. There would be nothing wrong with that if it came to that. But that isn't even necessary. We don't even have to worry about what we can save and store up for the 5 years previous to the sixth. Because God promises that I will provide for you in the sixth enough to take care of you for three more years. Leviticus chapter 25, beginning with verse 18. Verse 18. You shall thus observe my statutes and keep my judgments so as to carry them out that you may live securely on the land. Then the land will yield its produce so that you can eat your fill and live securely on it. But if you say, and he knew, again, God knew exactly what they'd be thinking. And he says, but if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops? Then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth a crop for 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth when its crop comes in. God says, I'll bless. It's like Malachi. He says, test God. Give Him a tenth of your increase and see if He doesn't open up the storehouses of heaven to you. But He expects us. You know, faith is, it's easy to say, I believe. It's a whole different matter if you're a farmer to say, I'm not planting a thing on the seventh year. I'm not going to harvest anything on the seventh year. Now that's faith. But God had already proved it true that He would indeed provide in such a situation. You remember when the Israelites were in the wilderness and they wanted something other than what they had at the time to eat, and God rained down upon them quail and manna from heaven? What did He do? How many days did He provide for them? Only six. Extra finger up there. Only six. Because He said, don't go out on the seventh. He said, that's my Sabbath. Don't go out on the seventh. Because you're not going to find any manna. He said, simply gather what I provide on the sixth, and it'll be enough for the seventh. And if God can do that, provide manna from heaven, however and whatever it was, and provide enough on the sixth day in order for it to last on the seventh day, when in every other case, on every other day, the manna spoiled and rotted, but somehow on the sixth day it lasted for an extra 24-hour period. If He can do that, then why shouldn't we believe as a farmer that He can provide in the sixth year enough to last 2 or 3 years? After all, He's the God of heaven and earth, the Creator of the universe, who put it all together and makes it all work. Indeed, if we're faithful unto Him, He will be faithful unto us. This last passage certainly also demonstrates that Yahweh is not against the survivalist food storage mentality that our present current government wants to paint as evil. I mean, you had to store up. You had to take from the sixth and store up. And it's providing for your own. And if you don't, you're less than an infidel, according to Paul's instructions to Timothy. It's also worth noting that we must also stop breaking Yahweh's anti-hybridization laws that are also found under the Old Covenant in order for His plan to be fully realized. Exodus 23, verses 10 and 11, in regards to this statute, it says, and you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield. But on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. In other words, in order to have any volunteer crop of any size to feed the poor of the land and the livestock with, we must return to using non-hybrid, open-pollinated seed, which, again, God made very clear was necessary. And, of course, the benefits of doing so are reaped by all of us, because with such seed, we will regain the nutritional value in our foods that's been lost. There's no nutritional value lost because we've hybridized it out of it. God said, don't hybridize your seed. That's the correct word. Because he knew, I mean, he didn't state why, he just said, don't do it. But we know with all things, when God says don't do it, there's a reason for it. And of course, now we find out. Now in our disobedience, we find out that there's nearly no nutritional value left in what you buy from the grocery store because of hybridization and pesticides and herbicides and disobeying so many of God's agricultural laws. Most people don't even know there's agricultural laws in here. God gave us everything we needed to live to the fullest extent of our lives, to be blessed in the greatest way. And of course, with such seed or with such crops from such seed, we will also return to the former level of health and wellness as a nation that we once had too. You look at our people, and especially I think we're on it. It's on a kind of a snowball effect right now. Because of the sins of our forefathers from maybe two, three, or four generations back, the sins of the fathers are visited onto the second and third and fourth generations. Right now, I think we're starting to see, and I think it's going to be, it happened in my generation, but I think it's going to especially be seen in our children's generation, how sick a people we really are. Because as each generation goes further along, the longer we've been disobeying God's agricultural and health laws, the worse it becomes. Now, I intend my children to be different. We feed them differently than what you normally are going to find out there. We obey God's food laws. We try to obey by His agricultural laws. We're not farmers, but by buying from people who use open-pollinated corn. For example, some of our people up in South Dakota provide our meat for us. They feed their beef on that. And doing the best we can to try to divert my children, at least, and my grandchildren from or at least rescuing them from the cycle that our people are in, with our sickness, our health, the heart problems, the cancer rates, the new diseases is multiplying on us. And that's all in accordance with God's promises too, when we disobey His laws. When the farmer returns to God's laws, we all benefit. It's really quite amazing when you, and not only in this area, but in every area of applicability of God, when we apply God's laws. It's really quite amazing when you see all the benefits of doing things God's way, that man ever forsakes it. It's like, you mean it could be this way? And you've left it? I mean, it was this way, this is the way God intended to be, and now we're living this way? It's quite amazing when you really visualize it. You know, if only if Yahweh would open the eyes of our people to see it. That's the problem, is that most of our people have been in disobedience so long, they're blinded to what's even possible. We need to be more urgent with our prayers, that God indeed, that our people indeed would have eyes to hear, or eyes to see and ears to hear. Time doesn't permit me in this message of getting into the second aspect of the sabbatical year, so that'll have to be put on hold until the next message. In the next message, I'll also address the 50th year Sabbath, and I should be able to get into the most important Sabbath of all. Another Sabbath that most people don't even know is a Sabbath, the most important of all. In the meantime, cry out, O Israel. Cry out, O Israel, for it's a crying shame, adulterating His righteous law, profaning Yahweh's name. Cry out, O Israel, for it's a sure disgrace. We bow to idols and pagan gods and seek not Yahweh's face. Cry out, O Israel, for we have turned away from Yahweh's covenant with Israel. We pervert His Sabbath day. Cry out, O Israel, for injustice in our land, allowing wickedness and silence. We have blood on our own hand. Cry out, O Israel, for we have been betrayed. We followed customs of Babylon, but now the price is paid. Cry out, O Israel, for Babylon will fall. Yahshua's coming back as king. It's time to heed the call. Cry out, O Israel. It's still a crying shame as we pollute the Sabbath day and desecrate His name. Will you cry out? I hope indeed you will. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer.